Greetings and connubial meritations, my staggeringly litotic listeners, and welcome to this August 2014 Science News Update. I'm your host for this overtly arousing science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. First, please forgive me for my voice. I am recovering from being ill. My son Eli, whom I have newly dubbed Typhoid Mario, has infected the whole family with some deadly summer flu. Although it put me in bed for 2 days, he showed almost no signs of having a 100-degree fever, cold, and cough affecting him at all. At any rate, bear with me. Before I get on with all the nummy little stories of the night, I will answer email from several listeners whose memories are apparently very long. Every summer, I attend a scientific conference. In this year's meeting, I went to the American Society of Plant Biologists conference in Portland, Oregon. It's a big, massive conference which has over 1,000 attendants. Several listeners actually wrote me to ask that I report on whatever conference I happen to be attending this summer. It was a nice gesture, and I applaud your interest, but some conferences actually lend themselves a bit better than others to being reported on. This conference was probably not one of the more gripping ones that I have attended. I was not exactly thrilled with the hyper-focus, in my opinion at least, of the physiology of non-biological environmental stresses. Seems to me that an awful lot of laboratories are being funded at very high levels to examine every abiotic stress that you can imagine, from drought to flooding to aluminum in soil to, well, just about anything. However, that said, there were a couple of plenary session talks that I actually thought were interesting. And sadly, those talks were from an economist and a nutritionist. One of the big themes of the plenary sessions was feeding 9 billion people in 2050. How is that for a science fiction theme? There were actually 2 days of talks on this topic. Day one addressed actual biology. How do we grow more per acre? How do we engineer genetically more healthy plants? What new, safer, and faster methods can be used to genetically engineer crops? How do we get better at growing plants in inhospitable environments, etc.? The speakers were especially interested in what they called food security, which just means having enough food to feed the growing populations. They discussed growing enough food to feed the world, use of agro-industrial and sustainable methods of production, agricultural drivers in developing countries, and the nutritional demands of food security. So essentially, day one was how do we produce more food for all those new people being born? Day two addressed the quality of that food, nourishing 9 billion people. And the speakers were not just plant biologists. There was an economist and a nutritionist who basically told hundreds of biologists that they were idiots and did not understand the real world. Much like Jon Snow was told again and again by Ygritte that he knows nothing in Game of Thrones. Dr. David Jenkins, MD, PhD, and Doctor of Science, is a world-renowned nutritionist who has a post at the University of Toronto, has won the World Food Prize, and holds the Canadian Research Chair in Nutrition and Metabolism. He told listeners that there's plenty of food right now, enough to already feed 9 billion people. How is this possible? Well, first, we need to stop wasting food in industrialized society. We waste at least 50% of what we buy and just throw away. In part because food is so cheap, especially in the U.S., we buy a cheap head of lettuce, assuming we will use it later in the week, and 2 weeks go by without the lettuce even being glanced at. Then we throw it away because it only costs a dollar or two. People do not do this in places in the world where food is expensive. In Japan, for example, the refrigerators are not the size of Hummers as they are in the U.S. They are quite small because the Japanese buy fresh food they need to cook meals from day to day, to reduce waste and the cost of feeding their families. Second thing is we need to stop eating so much meat. Not because Jenkins believes it's morally wrong to eat meat, but because we use a huge amount of arable land, at least 50%, in growing food for animals. So too much land is being used to feed animals as opposed to humans. Jenkins says if we cut down our meat meals in the West to at least once per week, it would not only be healthier for us, but it would allow more people in the world to eat by feeding fewer animals. Third, a huge amount of crops that could go to feeding people, such as corn, are being used to make fuel. By 2050, we may have to decide whether it's more important to make alcohol for fuel or actually feed other human beings. Finally, there's plenty of food in surplus throughout the world right now to feed starving millions. But for political and economic reasons, it's not being shipped or made available to people. That needs to change. Jenkins made it clear that he is not a socialist. He does not want to give away food. He understands that people labored and spent money to grow that food. But he does believe that a basic human right should be to have enough food each day to sustain your life. But the upshot is that the food is already there in a lot of that surplus grain. And part of the reason for this is government subsidies. We really need to get the government to stop paying giant corporations. No, the small farmer is a small proportion of that, to grow things like corn. The other speaker at that plenary session was an economist who specialized in studying small family farms in Africa in the attempt to make their running more profitable. This speaker was Dr. Alan DeBrow of the International Food Policy Research Institute. DeBrow has a PhD in agricultural and resource economics. He repeated much of what Jenkins said in his talk, but he added another fascinating component. Much of DeBrow's work has been trying to determine why household farms in sub-Saharan Africa are slow to pick up new advanced farming methods that would allow a great increase in farming efficiency and greater profits. He found that there are multiple political, social, and cultural reasons why the new technology is not adopted. And it's very complicated. There are even sexual and gender political reasons. He told one story about Ghana, where the married men and women kept separate farms and separate accounts. The men would not adopt any GMO crops because they were risk-averse and refused to try out anything that might lose them money. The women farmers, however, were more worried about their families and the overall economic state of the family. So they were willing to adopt GMO crops if it could profit and their children could eat better. And they did very well, getting a huge increase in their crop yields and profits. And the men got angry because they had done so much better than their husbands. And the men seized the lands and the crops from the women. Actually, later, DeBrow told me in a conversation that this type of gender politics is not isolated to Ghana, but is common all over West Africa in general. So you see, the world is a complicated place. The one important thing that DeBrow pointed out is that there is a huge amount of arable sub-Saharan land in Africa that can support crops, and is supporting crops now. But if we could convince all those primitive farmers to use more advanced methods, then Africa could feed itself in the next 50 years by increasing crop yields by 10, 20, or even 30-fold or more. Of course, Africa does need to straighten out some political issues, but we have time for that. Well, the upshot of the conference is that food should not veer into the Soylent Green territory by 2050 at least, if we keep our wits about us and see if government policies can't be changed. Let's get on with the first official story of the night. It happens to be an update in the worldwide BPA catastrophe which continues to haunt us. If you don't remember, BPAs are a category of chemicals found in plastics and certain inks that mimic estrogen compounds. They've been linked to a myriad of health issues, including worldwide reduction in male sperm counts across the animal kingdom and potential increases in female breast cancer. So what's the latest BPA problem? Unfortunately, it has to do with something that Brits call pot noodles and we in the U.S. call ramen noodles. Yes, instant ramen noodles, the beloved cheap dinner of college kids and budget eaters everywhere, have been linked to heart attacks and diabetes. And before you freak out and swear them off for life, let me tell you the whole story. Dr. Hyun Jun Shin, who led the study on behalf of Baylor Heart and Vascular Hospital in Texas, said instant noodles appear to be damaging to both men and women's health, although particularly damaging to women's health. The study appeared in the July issue of the Journal of Nutrition. Shin basically pointed up two problems with ramen noodles. The first is that noodles that are not fresh are a serious health threat. Noodles, like many processed foods, are high in salt, and a diet high in salt can increase the risk of heart attack and stroke. Additionally, the body struggles to digest dried ramen noodles. Shin used a tiny camera to look at the digestive tract of instant ramen noodles and then compare that to the digestion of fresh ones. Many instant ramen noodles, he said, contain the chemical tertiary butyl hydroquinone, a food additive that is a byproduct of butane and used in the petroleum industry. He stated, quote, "The most striking thing about our experiment, when you looked at the time interval, say 1 or 2 hours, was that the processed ramen noodles were less broken down than homemade ramen noodles," unquote. All this certainly did not thrill me. It never occurred to me that there were actually health issues with ramen noodles other than the obvious high levels of carbohydrate. Shin additionally did a statistical study of people who eat large amounts of ramen noodles to see if they were actually harmful. For the study, the researchers looked at the data of 10,000 adults between the ages of 19 and 64, collected via the nationally represented Korean National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey of 2007 to 2009. They found that eating instant noodles, ramen, lo mein, glass noodles, Thai noodles, or other noodles, twice or more a week, was associated with cardiometabolic syndrome, a collection of abnormalities affecting the body's cardiovascular, renal, and metabolic systems. So where does BPA come into all this? Well, Shin noted that problems from BPM might stem from the fact that most instant noodle meals come prepackaged in styrofoam, which contain bisphenol A, BPA, which is also why women could have been more affected in the study. But as I said before, it's not just the BPA. The ramen noodles contain plenty of unhealthy ingredients, including MSG and the chemical preservative tertiary butyl hydroquinone, and they're also high in saturated fat. Shin focused on South Korea because the country has the highest per capita number of instant noodle consumers in the world, and because in recent years health problems there, including heart disease and obesity, have been on the rise. But the findings appear to be quite relevant to consumers here as well in the U.S. The United States is now ranked 6th globally in instant noodle sales. The World Instant Noodle Association, yes, that does exist, found that the United States accounted for 4.3 trillion units sold in 2013, coming in just behind China, Indonesia, Japan, Vietnam, and India. What's the upshot of all this? Well, first of all, don't buy dried noodles that come in styrofoam packaging. And second, don't buy dried noodles that have lots of chemicals added to them like salt. Of course, you may be able to find your noodle fix in a noodle shop where they're made fresh, but I suspect that unless you live in a big city like New York, or you're from China or Korea, you're probably not going to find that very often. Well, I love my ramen, and I'm not exactly thrilled with this finding. Next story. Plants can sense their leaves being eaten. Notice I don't say hear. They cannot hear. Plants cannot hear music. They can't hear being eaten. They can't hear thunder. However, they can detect vibrations. Dr. Heidi Apple of the University of Missouri has been able to demonstrate that plants can detect feeding sessions of insects. The work was published in the July issue of the journal Oecologia. First, Apple placed a tiny piece of reflective tape on a leaf. That way, using a laser beam, she could measure the leaf's movements as the caterpillar munched on it. After that, she recorded what amounted to the inaudible vibrational sounds of the caterpillar chewing on the leaf. She then played the recordings back to one set of Arabidopsis plants, while silence was given to another set. To mimic the acoustic signature of feeding, she used piezoelectric actuators. These are tiny speakers that play vibrations instead of airborne sound. She says, quote, "It's a delicate process to vibrate leaves the way a caterpillar does while feeding, because the leaf surface is only vibrated up and down by about 1/10,000th of an inch. But we can attach an actuator to the leaf with wax and very precisely play back a segment of caterpillar feeding to recreate a typical 2-hour feeding session," unquote. Once she did that, she let the cabbage butterfly caterpillars eat about a third of 3 leaves on each plant from 2 sets. She gave the plants 24 to 48 hours to respond to the attack, after which the leaves were harvested. She then looked for a chemical called glucosinolate in the plants. Glucosinolates are common to the brassica mustard family of plants. They make mustard spicy and have anti-cancer properties and provide some of the health benefits to chocolate. Insects do not like the spiciness of glucosinolates, and when the levels of these are higher, the insects walk away or just don't start feeding at all. Well, the results were that plants with prior exposure to feeding vibrations released higher amounts of glucosinolate, while unexposed plants had lower levels of these chemicals. Apple concludes that feeding vibrations signal changes in plant cell metabolism, creating more defensive signals to repel the attack. So the take-home message for all of you who play music for your plants is that you may be inducing an anti-herbivory reaction in your houseplants. So, at the very least, they're less likely to be eaten, at least if they're in the cabbage mustard family. Next are more updates on stories that we have been following for a while. Yes, exoplanets and Bigfoot! You may remember last October when I reported an international team had collected dozens of hair and tissue samples and were trying to demonstrate that some of them belonged to Bigfoot. Of course, not one of the samples was anthropoid in origin and suggested it might actually belong to Bigfoot. However, a cool result came out of that work. Dr. Brian Sykes of Oxford reports in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B that 2 of the hair samples do not belong to Bigfoot, but they do belong to another mysterious species. More on that later. Sykes says that he did the entire project because, quote, "I was irritated that cryptozoologists kept saying that they've been rejected by mainstream science. At the time, I was perfecting a technique for extracting mitochondrial DNA from a single hair shaft. I realized I could do a proper scientific study. I wasn't looking for a Yeti or anything like that. I was just going to do a scientific review of the evidence," unquote. As I reported last year, Sykes and Dr. Michael Sartori posted a call for hair and other samples thought to be from Yetis, Bigfoot, or any other species unknown to science. The researchers would compare stretches of DNA to known species in GenBank, where there are thousands of species cataloged. He received hairs from famous expeditions, including a trek by the famous Sir Edmund Hillary. He also got hairs from museums, Buddhist relics, and quite a lot of material from Bigfoot enthusiasts in the U.S. He started with 95 samples, and then Sykes whittled that down to the 37 most interesting, and then from that 37, he was able to extract DNA from 30 of the 37. His latest paper from last month reports that most of the 30 samples turned out to be very ordinary animals in their natural habitats. The Yeti and Bigfoot hair samples turned out to come from bears, brown bears, black bears, polar bears, horses, raccoons, 1 human, some canines. The test apparently didn't narrow down if they were wolves or dogs, cows, sheep, a North American porcupine, a Malaysian tapir, and a sarow. I'm not sure what a sarow is. I think that's similar to a goat or an antelope. However, 2 of the hair samples from the Himalayas were a surprise. These hairs, both brown, perfectly matched a short stretch of DNA from the jawbone of a 40,000-year-old polar bear, although the hair markers did not match modern polar bears. 1 hair came from an animal shot 40 years ago in northern India by a hunter who reported that it behaved differently from typical brown bears. The other hair sample was collected about 10 years ago in Bhutan, 800 miles from where the first animal was shot in northern India. Sykes says, quote, "Our best guess is that the hares are from either an unknown bear species or a hybrid of brown bear and polar bear. Such hybrids are known in the Arctic, but genetically resemble modern rather than ancient polar bears. If there's a Himalayan hybrid, it might have descended from a different long-ago liaison between the species," unquote. Since the result is preliminary and Sykes is an actual scientist and not a nutcase, he is planning an expedition to northern India to search for live bears. Sykes goes on to say, quote, "The samples are from opposite ends of the Himalayas, so it's reasonable to imagine that there might be some still alive in between. I don't think the samples are a hoax, since they were collected decades and hundreds of miles apart and were provided by different sources. Plus, only an ancient jawbone is a genetic match," unquote. He concludes by suggesting that this previously unknown bear species may be what people there have seen and reported as a Yeti. He says that that would be consistent with those reports. Quote, "The Yetis have always been described as brown when they are seen. They are always brown. The idea of a white, abominable snowman came from TV shows and movies, like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer," unquote. Anyway, Sykes finally points out that, quote, "I have not actually disproven that Yetis exist. There's always some chance, however small, that the right sample just hasn't been collected yet. Now the Bigfoot and Yeti chasers can go back into the forest knowing that if they get a genuine sample, it can be identified and to a standard that everybody will accept," unquote. The next update is the exoplanet one I promised you. For once, this is not an encouraging one. This is a we-need-to-be-more-careful kind of story. In the July issue of Science, Penn State astronomer Paul Robertson and his colleagues reported that two planets considered among the most promising for life outside the solar system. Well, they actually don't seem to exist. The changing signals embedded in starlight that were attributed to moving planets may instead have been caused by, well, changing magnetic activity of their star. In this case, the star was Gliese 581. Although the study isn't the final word on these enticing yet controversial worlds, scientists say it reinforces the need for meticulous analysis to separate planet signals from those generated by spots and flares on stars. Robertson says, quote, "This is a big warning concerning the interpretation of small signals as being planets," unquote. And that seems like an understatement. Gliese 581 is located about 20 light-years away in the constellation Libra. In cosmic terms, that's pretty close. So it does make you worried about the planets around those more distant stars that are farther than 20 light-years away. Wow. However, Gliese 581 is small and it's dim, and it's similar to tens of billions of other stars in the galaxy, so you can see where astronomers might make mistakes. So, how embarrassing is this? Well, in 2010, the discovery of Gliese 581G, the planet which probably does not exist, grabbed headlines when co-discoverers Dr. Stephen Vogt of the University of California said, quote, "The chances of life on this planet are 100%, unquote. Oh, seriously, dude. Way to go out on a limb. That is not the way to keep credibility as a scientist. To make things worse for Vogt, multiple studies have found no evidence for Gliese 581G. Although you got to give him credit because he has stood by his claim. Robertson, however, has put a nail in the coffin of 581G. He looked at data from previous studies using the radial velocity method of planet discovery. That's where the subtle tug of a planet's gravity causes the star it orbits to wobble, and you examine that wobble. Astronomers can measure the wobble by studying starlight, which shifts color slightly depending on the direction of the wobble. Robertson set out to determine whether magnetic activity on Gliese 581's surface, a phenomenon similar to sunspots, could obscure some of the light and cause astronomers to incorrectly measure the wobble and perhaps mistakenly detect planets. Unlike previous groups that had looked at the data, Robertson and colleagues studied light emitted by energized hydrogen atoms as an indicator of Gliese 581's magnetic activity. The researchers found a clear link between the amounts of measured wobble and magnetic activity on the stellar surface. When Robertson and his team removed the signals thought to be from the star's surface, the evidence for three planets became even stronger. But the evidence for three other planets, including 581D and 581G, almost entirely disappeared. Well, oops. Robertson says, quote, "If you want to be confident you've found an exciting planet, then you have to do this type of analysis to make sure you're not being tricked by the star," unquote. As you can imagine, there's already controversy building between those who believe those planets exist and those who don't. The last story of the night, at least to me, falls into the Michael Crichton, what a horrible, potentially nightmarish idea line of science. And it all leads back to my first story about food. Imagine, if you will, a world in which you could lose weight simply by altering the flora of your gut. You would swallow a capsule with happy new bacteria that would block a high percentage of the nutrients getting into your body. And you would lose weight effortlessly while drinking chocolate malts and eating gut-buster burgers. Sounds like a dream come true to everybody that I know who battles weight problems. Well, Dr. Sean Davies, pharmacologist at Vanderbilt University, has proposed doing exactly what I describe above in the August issue of the Journal of Clinical Investigation. Trillions of microorganisms comprise our gut's microbiome. It's a vast and diverse ensemble of microbes, and they work together to help regulate our metabolic, neurological, and immune systems. It wasn't until recently that scientists really began to understand that we are a very complex organism made up of not just our own cells, but bacterial cells as well. However, it's thought that the imbalance of these microbial communities may cause obesity, diabetes, and even cardiovascular disease. Davies says, quote, "It has become clear that the types of bacteria that are sitting in your GI tract have a fairly significant influence on your risk for obesity. So what we're really doing is hijacking them to help us in a way that they normally wouldn't. Essentially, we're converting the gut bacteria into a drug delivery system," unquote. Davies has modified a probiotic strain of bacteria, E. coli Nissl 1917, to express high amounts of a hormone called N-acylphosphatidylethanolamine, NAPE. NAPE is a natural compound released by the small intestines when fat is being digested, and it activates metabolites that send signals to the brain to suppress appetite. So far, so good. From Davies, quote, "When people are eating high-fat diets or are obese, they are actually not synthesizing as much NAPE as they should be for that meal, so they don't have a sufficient feeling of satiation," unquote. The team tested their NAPE-expressing bacteria by feeding high-fat diets to healthy mice while administering the bacteria in drinking water. After 8 weeks, the team noticed that mice treated with NAPE-expressing bacteria had only 50% of the body fat of mice receiving either control bacteria or just drinking water by itself. Davies' team also found a sustained reduction in food intake that lasted up to 6 weeks after treatment, resulting in lower body weights for at least 12 weeks after therapy. So why do I have a problem with all this? Sounds great, huh? Well, two reasons. First, it's just way too easy for me to imagine that Michael Crichton, Stephen King scenario where the newly tested bacteria gets out of control and ends up causing somebody to waste away to nothing and die of starvation while eating continually. Well, nobody has ever called me a Pollyanna. Okay, and also, here's the more likely scenario and less silly. There is an evolutionary reason that humans store fat. At least in the industrialized West, we have not seen rampant hunger in 100 years. We store fats for the times when food is scarce. Fat is an evolutionary aid. It is not a hindrance. Fat is a good thing. Fat is not a bad thing. Now we have lots and lots of cheap food. Remember my comments at the beginning of this segment? We in the West eat and get fat because we have so much energy-rich food that we don't even realize how much we are eating. A McDonald's Big Mac has enough energy to last you the whole day, and yet we eat this with fries and still eat breakfast and dinner besides. What if the biologists and academics at the Plant Biologist Conference are wrong? What if in 40 years we have 9 billion people and food does become scarce? What about beyond that 40-year mark? Imagine a world in which food is scarce and yet humans, because we tinkered with bacterial genomes, are no longer able to store fat. Fat may be a bane now in the West, but it was something blessed at one time, something needed. In a world of scarcity, humans would starve much faster because they dared to mess with a basic metabolic process. It's just something to think about next time you curse those love handles or chubby hips. I'm not exactly a lightweight myself, and I would love to lose 30 pounds, and I try all the time. But even I think that Davy's idea is a dark and dangerous one. It's just me. That's all for me for now, and as always, take care. Cut way back on those pot noodles. Don't count your planets until they're hatched. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.